We are pleased to inform you that you have a place at Potterversity.
Welcome to Potterversity, a Potter Studies podcast. Today, we are going to talk about Harry Potter and the Aeneid as foundational cultural texts. Welcome to Potterversity. Today, we are going into the ancient past to talk about Harry Potter and the Aeneid as foundational cultural texts. I am Katie McDaniel, Professor of History at Marietta College in Marietta, Ohio, co-editor of Harry Potter for Nerds 2, and co-editor with Emily Strand of Potterversity, Essays Exploring the World of Harry Potter.
And I am Emily Strand, instructor of Comparative Religions and Cultural Competency at Mount Carmel College of Nursing, and co-editor with Katie of Potterversity, Essays Exploring.
Here at Potterversity, we love to talk about intertextuality. It's a big word, but it basically means the way that texts sort of talk to each other in a variety of ways. And the Harry Potter series does this a lot. On this episode, we're particularly looking at the important Roman text by Virgil called the Aeneid, and how Harry Potter is talking to it, and how it might even be talking back. Now, Emily, when you first read Harry Potter, did you have a sense that there were these other texts that it was in conversation with?
Probably not on the surface. I'm sure I've shared before that I'm such a plot reader when I'm first tearing through a book. That's why I have to read multiple times, because the first time I'm really just so focused on the plot. And I think, you know, that's probably like a lot of people, but I remember liking the book in the same way I liked reading Jane Austen books. You know, I remember loving the dialogue, you know, really, really living for the dialogue moments. And then, you know, my awareness kind of grew, and probably the next big text that I recognized that it was speaking with was the Lord of the Rings, you know, and Tolkien.
Right.
And so, yeah, and then it kind of grew slowly until, you know, I really realized how much the Gospels were speaking through this text, and that it was speaking back to the Gospels. And so, of course, that caught my attention as a religious studies scholar. What about you? Which texts peaked out at you?
Right. Well, I would say that I really did think I was reading a children's book the first, you know, when I first started. And I sort of wasn't really looking for much except that when I was a kid, I've said this before, like if something had witches in it, I would read it. Because I was, you know, I was into that. I was into all the magic and the witchcraft and the, you
You're
know,
witchy.
And I spent some time in my room trying to move objects with my eyes and my mind. So, you know, I was that kind of kid. And so I definitely saw it as within a kind of genre of young adult fiction that I had enjoyed when I was a kid. But I don't even necessarily think those are the ones it's particularly speaking with. I think in some ways, you know, like John Granger said, it's almost a parody of those kinds of things. And it's doing something that's connecting with older texts and also, you know, texts that are these foundational texts, which we are going to talk about today with our guest. So I think without further ado, I will introduce our expert guest today. And that is Dr. Mitchell Parks. He is Associate Professor of Classics at Knox College in Galesburg, Illinois. He teaches a variety of classes on the ancient world, ancient democracy, epic poetry, and Greek and Roman myths, His research interests lie at the intersection of ancient literature and political theory. I love that. I'm very interested in the politics of Harry Potter, especially. And he says he's, quote, interested in how literary works reflect and attempt to overcome the tensions that inevitably arise when humans get together in large groups, end quote. Wow, do we need to understand that better? Dr. Parks has a number of publications, but most interesting to us is his chapter in Lana Whited's The Ivory Tower, Harry Potter, and Beyond, which we talked about in our previous episode in general. But now we're going to look particularly at his chapter called Harry, Aeneas, and the Foundational Text. Welcome to the show, Mitchell.
Thank you, Katie. Thank you, Emily. It is a pure delight to be here. I've been having these major longtime listener, first time caller kind of vibes since I've loved the show for years and years. I've been cribbing from it for my syllabi forever. It's been so valuable to me as I've tried to see myself as a Harry Potter scholar. So I just have sheer delight being here.
That's wonderful.
Oh,
We
that's
love
great.
compliments, Mitchell. So thank you. I'm so glad. I'm so glad we finally got you on. I saw you maybe it was 2 years ago, and you were talking about Harry and Aeneas. And I was like, I think I turned to whoever I was sitting next to. It might have been Emily. Maybe not though. But I was like,
No,
we
I
gotta.
think I've missed. Yeah, I've missed your presentations, unfortunately.
I was like, we gotta have Mitchell on the show.
Well, that's kind
So
of
I
you.
think it was Laurie, our producer, Laurie Beckoff. Yeah.
Yes, it could very well be. I'm so delighted that we finally have the opportunity to have you on, Mitchell. So why don't you start by telling us how you first encountered the Harry Potter series and when you started taking it seriously as a text for scholarly study, as you say, to become a Harry Potter scholar?
So you mentioned John Granger a moment ago. I think he's the one who started dubbing us Generation Hex, the
Yes.
people who were Harry's age as the novels were coming out, and that definitely describes me. The books were extremely popular when I was in junior high, and people kept recommending them to me, and so naturally I avoided them like the plague. You could tell I was a budding classicist because it was new and popular, and therefore it can't be any good. Right. So that was a problem that I had. A dear friend of mine kept persisting in recommending them to me, and I thought, okay, I have to come up with something just terrible. So I picked something that he would have to experience as a trade. Right. So I thought, okay, I've seen Titanic. I don't think he'd like it. So you need to watch Titanic, and I'll read Harry Potter. And I have no idea if he ever watched Titanic because I picked up the Harry Potter books and loved them and never looked back.
Yeah, right. I don't think that was really an even trade there.
No, I don't think so. I mean, it's a good movie, but yeah, I think I got by far the better end of that bargain in there. So yeah, I continued. The last book came out when I was about to be a senior in college. So again, kind of grew up with Harry through a whole bunch of life transitions. I went from college to graduate school, you know how the process of scholarship and goes. I was mainly working on ancient Greek texts in grad school, especially while I was dissertating, studying Athenian democracy. But I've always had a soft spot for Latin epic and did a lot of work on Roman poetry on the side of things, and kept noticing how similar Harry Potter and a lot of ancient Roman narratives were, and to this is almost embarrassing to admit, to keep myself motivated while I was dissertating, I kept trying to recast little bits of the Harry Potter narrative into Latin poetry. No, you can't read my fanfic, but you gotta find everybody needs a hobby, right? So after I finished my PhD, though, I had a temporary contract in the classics department at Bucknell University. And I had the opportunity to teach a seminar for first year students, and on a topic of my choosing. So to my colleagues in the classics department, I pitched a class on Harry Potter and the classics, and they were extremely supportive. My goal was that it was going to be sort of a trap for the students, that I would use Harry Potter as the lure to get them into the room, and then
It's a
they'd suddenly
gateway
get
drug.
right. Yes, exactly. We call them gateway courses, I think. But yes, that's that is exactly the idea, that I would get them hooked on the ancient world by studying it through how Harry Potter interacts with those texts from ancient literature, and the trap backfired. It was a rebounding curse, which is to say, I suddenly found myself engaged with Harry Potter as serious literature in a way that I think I had been subconsciously before. But then, you know, I started reading the scholarship, and I started wanting to write my own scholarship and kind of talk back to the text in these ways. So I, you know, I think I have had students who have taken more classics courses as a result of this. And I should say I've, when I interviewed for my current position at Knox College, my job talk during the interview was actually on my Harry Potter course.
Oh, cool.
I did. It's a kind of a strange choice to take a course instead of a research topic. But I thought, oh, you know, they probably want something like this. And lo and behold, they did. So my colleagues here have been very supportive. And next year I'll be teaching this class for, I think, the seventh time, which
wow.
is a nice Harry Pottery number.
Yes.
Yeah.
And
yeah. Watch out, though. Watch out.
Right.
Strange
right.
things could happen.
Yeah. I don't want to accidentally create an eighth iteration of the course. That's yes. So we anyway, I managed to find myself drawn into wanting to do this and to really honestly be more motivated to do this work than a lot of other things that I've done in the past.
You know, I think so much of when we look at what's happening with higher education, there's this intense drive for everything to be relevant, you know, and to have like an almost even like future relevant to your future. And departments, you know, like history departments, but also classics departments have, I think sort of struggled to figure out like, how do we remind people that ancient texts are relevant? And connecting it with Harry Potter is just a really great way to do that. And I just have to say, Mitchell, I love that you have a soft spot for Roman poetry and that it was your side hustle as you were in graduate school. Listeners, take note, that is what graduate school does to you.
Yes.
Do you have any assessments of the Latin version of Harry Potter?
Oh, of the text itself.
Yeah,
Harry Potter. I bring it into my class and I compare it with how Google Translate turns the first paragraph into Latin. So I take the first page or so of Harius Potter et Philosophi Lapis and I give them the first page or so in that, and Google translates Latin as kind of an object lesson in, you know, machine translation is not all there yet.
Yeah.
Please use your human brains. By the way, maybe consider taking Latin. But it's fun. And I recommend that one and the Greek version as well to mm-hmm. students who need something between that year of the intro language and moving on to a more advanced level. You know, again, Katie, you were talking about relevance. People often think, oh, you know, I need to dive into the authentic texts. And well, no, as you're gearing up for the intermediate level, you need something familiar enough that you, A, have the intrinsic motivation to keep doing it, and B, that you've got enough mental hooks to figure out what's going on so you don't just get lost in the text that you're practicing reading. So there's a number of these Latin readers. There's Hobitus Ille, for example. Winnie Ille Pooh is out there as well. A number of the Dr. Seuss books. And I'm sure they make great money for the publishers as these kind of novelty items. But nonetheless, they can really help with that, overcoming the introduction to intermediate level gap.
Yeah, absolutely. Context is so important. And being able to, like, I think a lot, it's a lot of what reading is and language acquisition. It's when you don't know something, being able to figure out what it is because you have the proper context.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, really neat. Well, your essay in Lana Whited's anthology explains the importance of Harry Potter as a foundational text. And, you know, in a way, we're sort of talking here about foundational texts, whether they are ancient texts or like texts that have been created relatively recently. What do you mean by this phrase, foundational text?
Oh, that's a great question. So I want to first off say, regarding looking at the Aeneid in this light, I know you've already talked to Lily Panucci on
yes.
the podcast and her article on Catabasis, this journey to the underworld motif in both Harry Potter and the Aeneid. And so I was immediately intimidated because she's so much cooler than I am. And so, you know, the second I heard her episode, I thought, oh, gosh darn, they'll never want to talk to me about this. But I think, you know,
well, and
so
she was in Greece when we talked to her.
Oh, yeah. But she's absolutely wonderful. I finally had the chance to meet her last month, actually, on a panel at a classics conference.
Oh, cool.
She also uses this idea of foundational text, because the Aeneid is so well known as a text that describes Rome's foundation. Mm-hmm. In other words, it's often been understood as a foundational text in terms of political foundation. This is right. how the nation got started, in much the same way that, say, Hamilton provides a story of a nation's founding as well, kind of reprocessed in light of its own contemporary era. Just to give another contemporary example there. So in my essay, though, first off, I wanted to do something different from what she does in her essay. I'd already, again, we were talking a moment ago about the process of scholarship and how the sausage gets made. I had written my essay before I found hers. So I was doing this writing in 2019, right? And then her article comes out. And okay, darn, okay, what do I do about that? Well, the nice thing is, kids, for all of those listening, you can always find something else to say. And so what I wanted to do was take a wide lens on the question and to talk about what does it mean to be foundational in many different kinds of ways. Foundational as a work of literature, foundational on a personal level, foundational for identity groups, which does kind of shade into political foundation as well. So exploring the kind of multivalence of what it means to be foundational. One of the reasons that I'm interested in that word foundational when describing both the Aeneid and Harry Potter is that in my mind, I'm holding it up against those other words, which you might be familiar with, like great, like great books, or canonical works, or even, and this, I realized the irony in saying this, I am a professor of classics, classic, right? This word indicating that something is sort of the tippy top. It's a funny metaphor. That word classic comes from Roman census terminology. So people who were at the highest rank of Roman society in terms of their economic capacity were also the top of the Roman military hierarchy as well. So it's a term that says that if you're applying this label classic to a text, which they did in ancient Rome as well, it's a metaphor from this sort of economic military world of indicating that you are the elite in society, which is a very top-down way of thinking about texts, the sort of insurmountable achievement. You can't possibly rival the classic authors, whereas foundational flips the script on it. It puts those texts on the bottom instead and makes them a thing that other people build off later. And so what's important about this work is not that it's some sort of great achievement, floating out there in the ether that you can't possibly climb your way up to, but rather that it's something that a lot of readers have gone back to in order to do more stuff with and build on top of it later. And for those of you listening, I'm kind of gesticulating a ladder with my hands as I say that.
No, that's great. And let's talk about this foundational text of the Aeneid and mm-hmm. why, what makes it such a relevant text through which to view the Harry Potter series?
Sure. So as I say in my chapter, there's kind of two threads to this. One of them is what I would call cross-cultural comparison. Harry Potter is, I would argue, the predominant work of young adult literature nowadays, in terms of people's ability to catch references to it, in terms of its service as a foundational text that other things are built on. I'm sure that all of us can think of published novels that have built on this, all of the text blurbs that publishers use, like this year's Harry Potter, or things like that, which doesn't really make much. What does it mean to be this year's Harry Potter? Harry Potter is a century level phenomenon. So there's a sense that Harry Potter is that that foundational work for contemporary young adult literature. And I find the Aeneid relevant to put into comparison with it, because at least in many, many different times and places over the two millennia since the Roman poet Virgil wrote this, it has been a predominant work of young adult literature. which is to say, people have used it to teach young people how to be active members of their society. And people have also enjoyed it as a fictional text, kind of on both of those levels. You know, it's used in education for reasons of character formation throughout antiquity and late antiquity and into the medieval period and the Renaissance and the Enlightenment. It's really not until the early 20th century that people in, again, many different times and places in the world stop to engage quite so much with the Aeneid on this level. And part of that is the effects of World War I and World War II and hesitancy about these grand political narratives of the kind that the Aeneid puts forward. So, you know, in other words, I would argue that if we're looking for something from the human past that is an analog for Harry Potter, the Aeneid's a great one to run with, to look at, you know, how have people felt about it? And for me, that's extremely important as a classicist because we don't have time machines, right? And so if I'm interested in the question of, say, what was it like when this or that Greek tragedy, like Oedipus the King, first premiered, and how did people feel about it? Or what was it like when Virgil wrote the Aeneid and people were first starting to read it and react to it? We have some evidence for that kind of thing. It's mainly in the form of other literary works that react to it. We have occasionally, you know, for the Aeneid, we've got, interestingly, graffiti, for example, from Pompeii, including kind of cartoon illustrations where it's Aeneas, but he's got a dog's head. That just, you know, there's clearly
fan art.
There's tons of fan art and fan fiction based on the Aeneid from the immediate decades and much later on after that, after it came out. And so we get some limited evidence like that. But otherwise, for me, observing the Harry Potter phenomenon gives me a lens into trying to understand what these works that are now considered foundational were like when they were first born. The analogy that I like to use is that it's like astronomers who are, you know, using a telescope to look out at a big cloud of gas, right? A stellar nursery to see stars in the process of being formed in order to understand, okay, how was our sun formed? What does this look like now? So for me, looking at Harry Potter is in one part, looking at that stellar nursery, trying to imagine, okay, this is what it looks like when a foundational text comes around. And how can I go reapply that to the stuff that I study in my day job regarding ancient literature?
Yeah, I love that, Mitchell, because I think it's sort of like what you're doing is you're saying, like, I, in my contemporary life, I can see a phenomenon that's like the Aeneid, and that is helping me to bridge some of that distance between now and then. And I do think, like, as a historian, I always think that we underestimate how much people in the past were just like us, you know,
right.
And I love that idea that there's fan art and, you know, people, but also one of the things that you talk about is that the Aeneid itself is building on foundations like the Odyssey and the Iliad, and it's almost its own little mashup of a lot of different foundational texts that existed in the ancient world as well.
Oh yeah, exactly. And so this is that's a thread. The kind of other thread in the article is not only this cross-cultural comparison, but that the Aeneid acts like Harry Potter. Regarding other literature as well, in terms of what it ingests, recycles. In classics, we often use the word receive and reception to describe what it's doing in exactly that way. And so they're nice texts to put next to each other because they not only have been made to do the same kind of cultural work, but they also operate as, you know, in terms of how they construct themselves as texts in very similar ways. The other thing I was hoping to say regarding reasons to look at Harry Potter in this way is not only as a classicist getting to view, you know, how these ancient texts were formed in the first place, and, you know, sidebar on that, in classics, again, because so many of those early reactions are from these elite male sources, the nice thing about watching responses to Harry Potter is that you can start just the sheer diversity of people's responses to Harry Potter over the years and the fortune collections of this text over the last 2.5 decades or so, is that you can start to imagine, okay, what were those non-elite responses? What were responses from more marginalized people like for that? We can certainly cast ourselves into the mindset of the fact that there must have been people in the ancient world who loved works like the Aeneid, but also wanted to imagine them differently in ways that that don't survive in the record as well. And so Harry Potter becomes extremely useful for thinking along those terms.
Yeah. And one of the things I also like that you brought up, you know, I think there are probably a lot of our listeners who are like, the Aeneid, like I don't know anything about that. And I've got no connection with that at all. And one of the points you make is, yeah, you do.
And you right. It's on aware. Your money.
Yeah. Yep. It's so pervasive. And the founders of the United States, especially, were totally enmeshed in this kind of Roman Republic, you know, kind mm-hmm. of transition to empire. They knew all of that literature themselves, probably as young adults or as they're doing their Latin lessons or what have you, and that they brought intentionally a lot of Virgil into the early, you know, United States. So, mm-hmm. yeah, like you say, it's on the money.
Absolutely. Yeah. And it's, yeah, it, indeed, it's not just Roman stuff, but as you say, it is specifically Virgil that they're looking back to. All of those three Latin phrases that are on, for example, the US dollar bill, annuit coeptis, is from Virgil's, it's a phrase that's used in the Georgics, which is one of his poems, as well as in the Aeneid at a separate occasion. Novus Ordo Cyclorum is from Virgil's Eclogues, and then E Pluribus Unum, you know, that famous motto of the United States, is from a text that's not actually by Virgil, but in the 18th century they thought it probably was. So there's a long tradition of understanding this particular text as being by Virgil. And the fun thing about this one is that it's about a peasant farmer, two peasant farmers actually, who live together and have this kind of humble rustic life. And this depiction of the male farmer packing his lunch before he heads out to the field, and he makes this sort of pesto. And the line comes from making one thing out of multiple ingredients. So it's from this cool. It's from this pesto poem.
Yeah, sounds very salad. Italian.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah, and Jefferson loved the farmers. So
exactly. So that's that kind of Virgilian essence imbues the U.S. and still does. You know, in the chapter, I get into the fact that the National September 11th Memorial has a quotation from Book 9 of the Aeneid on the wall, which was extremely controversial among classicists because there was a big debate about, okay, how is the monument reading this text? Is this a good use of our Virgil? I guess is this representing what we think Virgil says? So that's sure. Another way in which this text is still very, very relevant to us.
Really cool. So let's get into some direct comparisons. And as you said, Lily Panucci, sure. she's done some of this particularly for the Underworld Journey, but mm-hmm. you have some other things to add. And particularly you are saying that you think the Deathly Hallows is particularly Harry's Aeneid. So how does that play out?
So in a couple ways, the first off, as the kids would say these days, the vibe. It's a little grimmer, a little darker. And if you're going through all of the classical epic heroes, Aeneas is probably the one who's most similar to Harry in this novel. He's got a difficult mission that's put on him. He feels like he's alone a lot of the time. He is constantly trying to get help from his parents in one way or another, but just can't quite make the connection. So they have a lot of similar struggles. There's differences too in that Harry is a teenager and Aeneas is middle-aged. There are other classical heroes like Orestes, for example, the son of Clytemnestra and Agamemnon, who map onto Harry pretty well too from other works. For example, Aeschylus's Libation Bearers, which is quoted as an epigraph at the start of Deathly Hallows. So I don't want to say that the Aeneid is the one, you know, magical key that unlocks the understanding of Deathly Hallows. I wouldn't want to read anything in those terms. But, you know, so on the one hand, it's Harry as a hero himself is very closely aligned with Aeneas. On the other hand, it's the structure, the overarching structure of the novel, which of course is so different from the other six, which have the school year plot to them. Whereas Book 7 has, I think on this podcast, it's been called The Camping Trip from Hell multiple times.
True.
for the first main chunk of the novel is that journey narrative, that difficult quest narrative. And then the second half of the novel, it's not really more like a third of the total page count, is Harry's arrival back at Hogwarts for the Battle of Hogwarts. I always imagine he must be very tired by the end of it because he wakes up at like 5 in the morning one day and doesn't go to sleep for at least a full 24 hours after that.
I'm so glad someone else is paying attention to that because that always bothers me. I mean, I'm just very sleep oriented, I guess,
Yes.
but I'm always like, God, get these kids
Yeah.
some
It's
food
just,
and a bed.
well, and how many hours are they hanging on to that dragon until sunset in May in Scotland, which must be quite late. And
Right.
that's, all of those problems. But yeah, so what I focus on in the chapter is the hinge or the pivot point. And the reason for that is that the way that the Aeneid is structured, and people ever since antiquity have pointed this out, is that Virgil is doing this kind of mishmash of the Iliad and the Odyssey together. The two Homeric poems that are his foundational works that he's constantly reacting to. A number of scholars, Joe Farrell, in a really excellent book, Juno's Aeneid, highlights this, have said that the Aeneid is essentially concerned with raising, though not actually answering, the question of, is Aeneas going to be more like Achilles or more like Odysseus? And is the poem going to be more like the Iliad or more like the Odyssey? The Odyssey, of course, has a happy ending. The Iliad does not. Achilles is kind of a monster. Well, Odysseus is also kind of a monster, but he has a happier outcome in a lot of ways. And in the ancient tradition, Achilles is seen as a kind of paradigm of a bad king, the kind of leader you don't want because he's super selfish. And again, many modern readers would feel that Odysseus is super selfish, but at least in his own self-presentation in the poem, he comes across as a good king. So in the ancient tradition, you've got, is Aeneas going to turn out selfish like Achilles, or a kind of team player like Odysseus, and that's the constant tension throughout the epic, is which of these role models from those foundational texts is Aeneas going to fall into?
I like how the reading takes into account that the people who are taking in the Aeneid also know these other texts, to have a sense for, what is shaping the response of audiences to the text, which I think is such a fascinating aspect of literary criticism.
Oh, absolutely. And you get more depth of meaning from having that contact, though of course it's not required when you read it. You don't need to enjoy Snape. You don't need to have read The Tale of Two Cities beforehand, for example. Just to things that are the kind of plot patterns that he falls into. So in terms of
But
the
you should
structure,
read
oh
it at some
yes, it's
point. You
true.
should
True.
read it.
That's yeah, it's a good novel.
And having read it, you can then, kind of see, is this going to play out in a way that's like that, or will it play out in a way that actually corrects for something in that
Right.
novel?
Yeah, the intertextuality raises the question, and again, without necessarily answering it. And we might get to another one of those moments in a second. So in the Aeneid, people have often pointed out that the first half, Aeneas is kind of wandering around the Mediterranean. So just mythological background, he is a survivor of the Trojan side of the Trojan War, right? The Greeks have fought this war to get Queen Helen of Sparta back, the face that launched a thousand ships in Marlowe's language. And the Greeks have, after a 10-year war, destroyed the city of Troy. And in the Aeneid, we get a kind of flashback as Aeneas retells his trauma from the event of that, and he describes how for 7 years, he and his family wandered, and his followers, the Trojan remnant, these refugees, wandered around the Mediterranean trying to find a new home. He eventually, at the start of Book Seven, this is a 12-book poem, so books 1 through 6 are the wandering half, the Odyssey half, in other words, the kind of journey story. Books 7 through 12, he lands in Italy and has to make a new home for himself. And as with many people who try to colonize a new land, there are new people. There are not new people. There are already people living there at the time. And so he has to negotiate this tension between, okay, my refugee population needs a place to live. On the other hand, there are people already here. They end up in a situation of war. And that makes books 7 through 12 very much like the Iliad, where once again, Aeneas and his Trojans find themselves besieged by enemies, just like they were besieged in the city of Troy in the earlier part of their own backstory. And so it is, so there's the structure of the Aeneid for you, one half Odyssey, one half Iliad.
Yeah, and I can already see Deathly Hallows mapping out on that. That's such a great description of those two and how they're in the Aeneid. And then that's Deathly Hallows right there. Right. It's there, the camping trip from hell. And then it's Battle of Hogwarts, right? Mm-hmm.
And a Battle of Hogwarts where technically Harry, like Aeneas, is the invader, but finds himself on the defensive because he and his friends have control of the castle and are being besieged by the Death Eaters in that same kind of, okay, you're coming back home again sort of move.
But also, whose school is this? Is this Tom Riddle's school or Voldemort's school, or is it Harry's school? Yeah, interesting.
This question of identity, which the Aeneid ultimately resolves in book 12 by saying that, okay, all of these peoples who are currently at war with each other, we're going to retroactively call this a civil war because they're all going to be future Romans. They will all eventually be incorporated into the community, even though they fought at this foundational moment. We've got this tension between the different groups involved, but they all get lumped in together. Very, very similar to the scene in the Great Hall at the end of the novels where everybody is sitting without respect to what house they're in. The Malfoys are just kind of kicking around there as well.
Trying not to get arrested.
Exactly. this moment of unity after the conflict has simmered down. For me, the kicker, though, for identifying the parallel structure is the thing I explain in the chapter, namely that in Book 7 of the Aeneid, the war gets started. It is the situation is initially peaceful. Aeneas has good diplomatic relationships with the people in Italy where he lands. But the force that opposes him in the poem is the goddess Juno, who wants to do everything she can to stop the rise of Rome because Rome is going to squash her favorite city, Carthage, in a number of centuries. And so she wants to delay the eventual rise of Rome for that reason. And so she causes trouble for Aeneas by stirring up a war. To do that, she sends a fury, one of these goddesses of the underworld with snaky hair and all sorts of other monstrous features, to go inspire a number of the combatants on both sides of the war with violence, with a desire to strike out at each other. And one of the things she does, she takes a snake from her hair and throws it at the queen of the local Italians, Amata, and gets her to start stirring up a war spirit in her local community, that kind of thing. The hinge point there is, in my view, directly connected to Deathly Hallows, because the moment it switches from the journey to find the Horcruxes plotline into we are in a situation of war plotline is also affected by a character named Alecto. So Alecto is the name of Juno's fury. Alecto Caro is also the name of the Death Eater. She's the one who presses her dark mark, which of course has a snake on it, just like the fury snakes, in order to summon Voldemort. And that's what essentially starts the timer to when Hogwarts is going to be invaded, while Harry's still in the middle of trying to do the whole Horcrux quest. And so there's a moment where intertextuality helps us see those parallel structures and everything else that leaps out of the woodwork from there.
Wow. That's a great spot. That's a lovely deep dive into that moment.
Sure.
I feel like it's got to be intentional.
I am an intertextual person, and that means that I don't deal too much in terms of authorial intent. I was just really loving your episode with Dan White that dropped earlier this week, where you engaged in that question with him as well, in terms of, okay, we want to see, we're interested in this idea of craft where composers are doing musical things, making these illusions intentionally, but we also want to see how people who consume the films, more normal people than people who have PhDs in music, for example, as he himself said, are interacting with these things. things and processing these things. And so, you know, for me, this is kind of bonus that a reader can pick up on. And I'm more interested in, okay, what does this mean for you as a reader at the point of reception? How does this impact your understanding of Harry Potter? And there's more I get into in the chapter. In terms of what then happens at that moment, the kinds of narrative effects that get triggered by that, that I could go into if you want.
Well, we got to leave something for please. People to read in Great. The chapter yeah. because, you know, it's a fabulous chapter and it's a fabulous mm-hmm. book. And it's The Ivory Tower, Harry Potter and Beyond, edited by Lana Whitehead. It really is great. And so I hope listeners can get a hold of it and read the whole chapter for themselves. In the chapter also, you talk about the way that the two works influence each other, which is, you know, at first kind of like a what? You know, how can like, you know,
that's not how time works,
right? That's not how time works, Mitchell. Come on. Like, what's going on here? So how, what do you mean by that? Tell us more about that.
Right. So a lot of people are used to thinking about literature in terms of more author-centric ways of reading, which is to say that the author controls the meaning of the text and inscribes it into, say, the book, and you're there to pick it up and process and kind of work out the series of clues to what the author means. And I'm not, you know, that is a good way of reading texts. It's totally fine. I prefer to see this kind of intertextuality as a process. And here I'm riffing on something somebody in my own field has said at one point, that the author begins but can't control. And, you know, you are free to take these texts and put them in conversation with each other, even if you don't necessarily suspect that the author has read them and has sort of perfect control over how the author is deploying them.
I like that a lot, Mitchell. And I think you can see that in the Harry Potter fandom as well and scholarly yes. arena.
Oh, absolutely. And especially in these moments of controversy, you know, Rowling's repeated calls recently for limitations on trans rights, which, for the record, I don't agree with, have certainly made people wary of reading the novels as a kind of author-centric production. And this idea that you can kind of take back the text in interesting ways, again, not only is true to life and true to how readers respond to it, but helps me process how people might have bounced off of these texts in antiquity and done new things with them that speak to concerns that we don't normally get represented in the sources. It brings me back to 2 years ago, Ben Cromwell's talk at the Harry Potter Academic Conference, where he was looking at Harry Potter spite fic tags and the way that the various authors have written these actually very heartwarming stories about Harry Potter, these heartwarming fanfics, in an attempt to reclaim the themes of inclusiveness from how they see the author running against their idea of how the Harry Potter series works. I think he's now got that as an article in Transformative Works and Cultures, which I have used and cited. It's a lot of fun.
Yeah, right. I know. I love to see all that energy. And one of the things that I think is, you know, really interesting about what you're saying is that we can sort of take Harry Potter and then we can also, you know, we can see that the Aeneid is offering maybe some alternatives to Harry Potter. And I'm very interested in some of the ways that it does that. One of the scenes that I was really interested in that you did a kind of strong reading of is the end. I don't know if I'm jumping ahead.
Oh, please. That's
what
fine.
You want to talk about, but
spoilers for the Aeneid.
Yes. Yeah. As I always tell my students, there's no spoilers for 2,000-year-old literature.
There you go. Right.
You know, you've had 2,000 years to get caught up.
You've had your chance.
Yeah. Right. So you talk about how in the Aeneid, Aeneas is facing his major foe at the end, and he does the same thing. They're in kind of in a duel, and he does the same thing where he sort of asks him to show some remorse, and the fellow does show remorse, and then Aeneas is like, but Colin Creevy, and then kills him.
Yes, yes, sir. Exactly. It is as if Harry gave in to his vengeance urge, right? So at the end of Half-Blood Prince, for example, he's thinking about this journey he's about to undertake to go track down the Horcruxes, and he thinks to himself, and if I run into Severus Snape, so much the better. This desire to exact violent vengeance on people, which he manages through his process of grieving Dumbledore Dumbledore and grieving Dobby, and that scene in the grave at Shell Cottage in Deathly Hallows, where he manages just to shed that revenge impulse, makes him very, very different from Aeneas in the end. Aeneas is trapped, of course, because he, you know, the not only actual history, but the plot of the poem mean that he is going to lay the foundations for the city that a couple centuries later will be founded as Rome by his descendant Romulus. And so he kind of has to keep rolling along the track of the plot, even if he doesn't want to. But yes, at the very end, and this is so striking because the poem ends there. There is no epilogue for the Aeneid, and people in the century since have written epilogues for the Aeneid. Ovid, in the generation after Virgil, incorporates something of a fanfic ending for the Aeneid into his famous epic, The Metamorphoses. There's a Renaissance author, Maffeo Veggio, who wrote a text called Aeneid Book 13, which again supplies a conclusion for the Aeneid, but it ends starkly with Aeneas killing his foe, this guy named Turnus, in combat, in order to end this this threat to Roman destiny that Turnus represents, this kind of roadblock on the way to the future foundation of Rome. And the reason he does it is that he has this sudden burst of emotion, this burst of anger on recognizing that that Turnus killed a friend of his and is wearing a belt that Turnus had pilfered from the guy's corpse. And so that physical reminder of this love that Aeneas felt for his friend causes him to snap in that last in the very last lines of the poem. And the last thing that the poet says is, you know, Turnus's soul flew down to the underworld, and the poem is over.
Wow.
Leaving you know you're right. But as the reader, that Rome is going to happen, right? And the poem has had many prophecies, much like Harry Potter,
sure.
Many prophecies that look forward to what's going to happen later. So you know that there will be centuries of Roman history after that moment where the poem ends. But the poet ends on that note. Many people have read that as sort of a grim recognition of the price that we pay for progress, or of the unfortunate ways that sometimes history happens.
Mm-hmm. I find it so interesting, though, if you think about like a modern reader who's read Harry Potter, who then reads Aeneid and is it, like sees, oh, hey, right. And that you're seeing that there are alternatives for how these stories and these characters can play out. And then it leads you to think about like why the difference and, you know, what does that mean? And what do I think is the right way for that to have unfolded?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that has a lot to do with their parents as well, which gets us into one of the other questions on your list, in that Aeneas is the son of the goddess Venus, the Roman version of Aphrodite. Venus in Latin means sex. She's the goddess of sex. His father was a kind of member of the Trojan royal dynasty, though not the branch that was in power. His dad's name was Anchises. And so he's this demigod, child of a goddess and a mortal man. And Venus's goal, you know, what's my motivation in this scene? Her motivation throughout the poem is to make Roman destiny happen, just as her rival Juno's motivation is to slow down Roman destiny and try to keep it from happening at all costs. So on the kind of supernatural level of the plot, those are the forces that are at odds with each other. And so Aeneas, in other words, is the son of the goddess of love. He's the son of this divine force of love, which again makes him parallel to Harry in interesting ways, since his mother is also representative of this transcendent power of love. Harry struggles throughout the series in terms of, okay, can I live up to being my father? Can I live up to being James? And then later, of course, can I live up to being Dumbledore? And the answer is no. Both of those models aren't models that he necessarily should follow. James is a very kind of swashbuckling, more vengeance-oriented, you know, at least as we see him as a teenager, which of course is unfair.
And privileged, right? He had
privilege.
Some privileges that Harry, you know, is he's just more of an underdog than James ever was.
Right. Whereas Dumbledore's got the good strategy that does win out in the end, but his his mode of accomplishing it is to go it alone, and Harry has to reject that too. So he ends up needing to reject his paternal influence and realize what he could have learned from Snape long before, that he should have been following his mother's path of self-sacrificial love instead. And that's what enables him not only to win, but also survive at the end of Deathly Hallows. Aeneas too, can, you know, he could be a leader like Anchises. And when he meets Anchises' ghost in the underworld, Anchises tells him that the goal of being a Roman, of course, Aeneas isn't a Roman yet. So it's a little weird for Anchises to be saying this kind of by means of prediction. But the goal of being a Roman is to conquer the proud and spare the humble. That's what it means to be a Roman, to put down people who are above their station and to rescue those who are downtrodden. But at the very end of the poem, does he do it? Becomes the ultimate question. And he seems instead to align himself with his mother, the goddess of love, whose goal is not self-sacrificial love like it is in Harry Potter. And this is the big difference between these two works. You know, intertextuality is as much about finding points of difference as it is finding points of similarity. Venus's sort of love is imperial. It's acquisitive. It's a kind of greedy love, the desire to get stuff and make stuff happen. And by giving into that, Aeneas removes that obstacle to Roman destiny and lets Rome happen, but not along the same ethical code necessarily as the one that he could have picked from his father.
Yeah, that's really cool. And especially I'm thinking about Emily's chapter in
Yes.
Ivory Tower, Harry Potter and Beyond. Emily, you talk about various parental styles, but then, and you sort of talk about that across the series, but then you spend a lot of time talking particularly about Lily and her motherly love and the effects of that on Harry. So how, Emily, do you want to give us some ideas about how you read that also as a kind of divine, like Mother Mary kind of divine
Right.
influence on our protagonist?
Yeah, I mean, you know, the chapter really was inspired just by my observation, and which I think Mitchell shares, of how important parents are in this story, which is perhaps ironic for a story about an orphan, you know. And then, you know, I started to get into it, and then I wanted to make this point about how differently we can look at this, you know, we can look at this from the psychological point of view of these parenting models that have kind of been the psychological norm, you know, for talking about parenthood. Nobody has really been able to improve on them much since the mid-20th century. You know, when you've got people modeling these parent styles and then the child outcomes don't match, you know, what they're supposed to do in the story, you know, Harry doesn't turn out the way, you know, children from these abusive households turn out, you know, then you have to question, like, who are really his parents? Who are really operating as his parents in the story? And any story that's as kind of theological and spiritual as Harry Potter, at least in my view, you know, is going to rely on some divine parenting models. And so I also talk about the difference between James's influence on Harry and Dumbledore's influence. And James's is pretty minimal, you know, I mean, or at least, you know, I like the way Mitchell, you were saying that, you know, he tries, you know, to be like his father, but maybe either that doesn't come as naturally to him or it doesn't get him the results that he needs to solve the story problem, you know, and defeat Voldemort. And so really he does need, in a sense, he does need Dumbledore's example. Because there are going to be times when he has to go it alone. And in the end, Dumbledore sacrifices himself as well. And this amplifies Lily's influence on him. It kind of drives him back to Lily's influence on him. And it is very Marian. You know, in a sense, Lily is she represents as a muggle-born, she kind of represents the inbreaking of magic into the mundane world, you know, and of course, this could be seen as a big metaphor for, you know, the human existence in relationship to the divine of, you know, in Christianity, we do believe that there is this inbreaking of the divine into human life. And it offers this invitation to the divine life through this, you know, the source of this inbreaking. And of course, you know, in the Christian Catholic tradition, especially Mary, the mother of God, is the kind of, you know, the source of the source, you know, of this. And so there's, of course, there's a lot of ways that the text points to this and fosters this kind of interpretation through even Lily's name, because, you know, the lily is often a symbol of Mary, or is she seen holding lilies, or I don't know, maybe she smelled like a lily. I'm not sure, but they do smell nice. But you know, so there's all these different ways that the text kind of supports this kind of reading. You know, if you're into that, it really enhances the text. I don't know that it's absolutely essential to a reading. I've wrestled with it over the years, but you know, I guess my overarching argument is that you can't just take the psychological models as your only point of reference in thinking about what parenting means in this story. You know, parenting in the story is also this kind of acceptable path to immortality, right? And that's what it is in our real world too. You know, this is how we live on. We can't live on through, you know, I mean, maybe we will someday, maybe John Anthony Dunn will come and tell us all about transhumanism and you know, but we, you know, that's not the reality now. You know, the reality of for the human, you know, experiences that you live on in the faces of your descendants and in the interests and the likes, and even they don't even have to be blood descendants, you know, the way you've been able to influence the next generation. So,
and isn't that so Aeneas? Isn't that also so Aeneas, right?
Right.
Yeah. He's a founder of a whole civilization.
And what right. is his legacy going to be as that kind of political founder too? Mm-hmm. Yes, well, Emily, I loved reading your chapter. Katie, I love reading your chapter too.
Oh,
I should acknowledge as well.
Not totally relevant to our discussion, right. but yeah.
Yeah, but Emily, your chapter, I should also say, made me extremely nervous because, of course, as I'm reading it, I'm sitting there thinking, oh God, what kind of parent am I, right?
Doesn't it do that to you? No, it's really like, because I've been thinking about that a lot as my child kind of makes this transition from grade school to middle school into high school. Mm-hmm. And I'm seeing these things and I know things about, you know, various family members, the way I was raised, the way my husband was raised, and the different outcomes that we see. And doesn't it make you nervous?
Yes.
Yeah, because there are four parenting styles, mm-hmm. but only one of them is acceptable.
Yeah, well, and I love to, you know, and I was trying to figure out where do I walk the line in terms of do I act like the Weasleys as Emily describes them? And what I really loved is that you pointed out the psychological toll that takes on Molly, right? So that the good parenting is also kind of self-destructive that was kind of therapeutic to read. To be honest.
So that was
nice. But I think that, you know, you're absolutely right in terms of how Harry Potter is using the Christian context as well. And when I teach my course on the classical world of Harry Potter, I always specify, by the way, we're doing pagan literature here. We could be running this whole course over in religious studies along completely different lines as well. And the way that I mark that is to say, okay, here are these two epigraphs at the start of Deathly Hallows. There's the one from Aeschylus's Libation Bearers, and there's the one from William Penn, celebrated Quaker thinker, right? And in many ways, those twin epigraphs at the start of Deathly Hallows are kind of the twin cores of the novel, you know, sort of like Harry and Voldemort's wands.
Well done.
I suppose in the way that they, the way that they engage with each other, the way they kind of push back against each other and can be read in tension with each other in exactly those ways.
Oh, I'm going to use that, Mitchell. I'll cite you because that's great. Because even she has said, you know, again, not that we necessarily care what the author intended, mm-hmm. but she has also said that those two are so huge, mm-hmm. you know, in interpreting the book. So
yes,
right. Parenting. It's important.
Yeah, I know. And you know, like you say, like parenting's surprisingly important in both a schoolboy novel and when you've got an orphan who's at the center of the whole story. So yeah, it is mm-hmm. interesting to think about.
And it goes all the way back to Catherine Grimes's piece back in the first Ivory Tower volume, mm-hmm. Which is about tracking Harry as one of these kind of mythical archetype heroes, mm-hmm. As part of the family romance, this kind of Freudian inspired idea that myths are all about, you know, ultimately how people construct their relationships with their family members.
Yeah, really cool. And of course, very relevant. This is how this literature always, you know, it's so relevant to the human experience. Mm-hmm. So Mitchell, mm-hmm. you did at the last Harry Potter Academic Conference at Chestnut Hill College, you did a really cool reading of actually kind of an image from mm-hmm. the Tales of Beetlebard that show, again, the fruits of knowing some classics, right? And also ancient languages. Mm-hmm. And it was a mic drop moment for the people who were there.
Thanks.
Like, what? Like, I think the comments were all like, my mind is blown. And you're particularly talking about the tale of the three brothers. And
Yes.
in that book, there is a drawing that is J.K. Rowling's drawing of a grave. And it's got some war letters on it, but a lot of this is obscured by very like smudges and things that look like they're maybe squiggles or flowers or plants or something. And you did a kind of reading of that gravestone, and I wondered if you could replicate that for us on the podcast today.
Oh, yes, absolutely. I would love to. So this was at the Harry Potter Academic Conference. It was the second year I'd gone, and I just I've really loved that conference environment so much too. I
Yeah, it's
should say
fun.
that
Yeah.
it's a breath of fresh air. I came back from the first one that I went to in fall of 2022, and just sat down and started writing in a way that writing has never been easy for me, and just words spewed out of me like a torrent, working on writing more about Harry Potter and the classics. It was so inspiring for me. So I was super excited to come back in 2023 and present this thing that I'd found a number of years earlier and shared with my classes. And it is Latin related. And to give a little context on the talk, I was talking a lot about how old texts, Latin texts, and ancient runes, all of those things in the books are used as ways to talk about tradition and whether tradition is good or bad. And again, I think that the novels raise that question without necessarily answering it. That Hogwarts is a place that's steeped in tradition, but a lot of those traditions are exclusive and terrible, and probably would be gotten rid of under any normal schooling system. But Hogwarts is very stuck in the past, right? And the use of Latin is one of those. And this is coming out of that tradition of the school story, Katie, as you were saying, that this is why are parents here in a school story? That Latin is so prominent in those British boarding school novels as well as the thing you need to succeed in order to get ahead in life. There's so much pressure around it. Neville kind of agonizes about if he's going to take ancient runes, in order to will that look good for him? Hermione latches onto it immediately. So in addition to the fact there's a lot of literal Latin going on in the novels, Ancient Runes fills that kind of cultural gap as well in the Hogwarts curriculum that that Latin fills. So I could go on about that all day. Latin is good and bad in a lot of these traditions, but it's remarkable to me. And sorry for, of course, those of you listening. I'm going to pull up an image here to walk through, but you can find it in the Tales of Beedle the Bard edition, the one with Rowling's own illustrations. And this is, there have been subsequent editions that are illustrated by other people that have come out since then. So this is the kind of original 2008 one. And this gets us into funny questions of authorial intent, right? Because it's pretty hard to analyze this without leaning into authorial intent in a way that I don't normally do in my writing. But unlike with intertextuality, it's, she's clearly made some marks with a pen here that are interesting to me.
Right. Yeah,
So,
she's the artist in this particular case.
exactly. So this volume represents Hermione's translation of the Tales of Beedle the Bard, right? Tradition is good and bad in the Harry Potter novels, and a lot of old texts are really scary, like the ones in the restricted section, and won't necessarily give Harry and his friends the answers they need to solve their quests. It turns out, though, that this other old text is a set of tales for children, Beedle the Bard, and it's absolutely vital for them to achieve their quest, and also for the reader to unlock a number of the themes of the novel through processing this story, the tale of the three brothers.
And of course, they have to process it through ancient runes.
Yeah, that Hermione seems to be translating on the fly for them, and just sitting down in front of them. It's never very clear in the novels whether runes are a writing system or a language or kind of both. The references to them are really blurred in that way. I could go on about that for a long time, but anyway, this Tales of Beedle the Bard standalone book is presented as Hermione's translation with Dumbledore's notes, which very much makes it resemble a text in my own field of classics. This kind of translation of ancient literature with commentary on it to help you understand it. And it includes the illustrations by Rowling herself. In the version of the story of the three brothers, we have the illustration of Ignotus Peverell's tombstone, which, of course, everybody remembers from the Godric's Hollow sequence in Deathly Hallows, right? Hermione stumbles on this in the Godric's Hollow graveyard, and she's able to make out the image of the symbol of the Deathly Hallows and can read the name Ignotus Peverell. Ignotus, of course, being the third brother who takes the invisibility cloak. Ignotus means unknown or unrecognized. Which is appropriate, of course, for his role as the guy who manages to escape the notice of death and kind of live incognito, right? So that's where his name is coming from. Anyway, Hermione recognizes that. Also important for context is that this is, of course, Deathly Hallows, which has those two epigraphs at the start of it. Those quotations from actual real-life Muggle literature, and in the Godric's Hollow sequence is the, I believe, only place in the novels themselves where Muggle texts are quoted in the text of the novels, namely with the two scriptural passages on the tombstones of the Dumbledores and the Potters. And so, in terms of how the reader is supposed to process the twin epigraphs at the start of the novel and these twin epitaphs, inscriptions on tombstones, in the middle of the novel, I think has a lot to do with what the novels are trying to do with literature, as literature, to kind of guide the reading process. Because, of course, Harry and Hermione have that whole long conversation about how do you interpret something that you find on a tombstone, right? We think about the author, we think about the purpose, we think about the context, we think about where it's coming from, which they don't actually do in the novel itself. That's left as an exercise for the reader to figure out that, oh, it's the New Testament being quoted here, right? So that conversation takes a step further with this illustration. In the illustration, there's a number of other marks on the tombstone. It's clearly very worn and damaged. In my field, we call the reading of inscriptions on hard surfaces epigraphy. Related to that word epigraph, an inscription at the front of a text. This is epigraphy, reading stuff off a rock. And at the very bottom of the tombstone, there are traces of other letters there. So you can see what Hermione saw, Ignotus Peverell's name, as well as traces of other letters. You can see the outlines of a T, a U, an F, an O, an N, and an E pretty quickly. But there's a lot of other gappy stuff. Using kind of zooming in on it myself and using my knowledge of Latin, which I suspected this was when I first saw it, I could fill in some other context for it to get other letters in this, in what turns out to be a fairly short four-word phrase. The traces are better for the second line, where you can fill in this phrase, amor manet, which means love remains. The traces are worse in the first line, but it's a much more famous phrase. It's the Latin quotation "tempus fugit," which, of course, comes from Virgil. Like everything, it seems, time flies, life is fleeting, is what "tempus fugit" means. And so, this whole phrase together, "tempus fugit, amor manet," we've got, life is short, but what remains for us is love. That same thing Emily was talking about regarding this immortality through your parenting, through the love that you bestow on other people, is how you can achieve actual immortality in this world. And so that's a motto snuck into the drawing, this kind of secret Latin, right? Latin is used as a tool of exclusion all throughout the boarding school novel, and it's used in some dodgy ways in Harry Potter that are kind of exclusionary too. But then nonetheless, here in kind of secret, you have to be in the club to find it kind of writing, it seems like we have here a useful motto summation for the plot of the novels, for the themes of the novels, rather. Tempus fugit, amor manet.
And how appropriate that line two is easier to work out, right? Because love remains, right? The earlier, tempus fugit, it's worn away, right? Because that's what time
Oh
does
yeah,
to.
life is fleeting. There you go. Yeah,
Right. It's kind of.
tempus edax rerum. Time is the eater of matter, is another famous Latin tag. Yes, it eats away stuff.
Reinforces the meaning of the two phrases.
Yeah, I love that. I mean, I love that you can sort of see the intersection of this in the visual as well as the textual. And it's a visual in an ancillary text that we don't see in the books themselves,
Well, and
but it's
the whole
coming
point
around and
of
influencing it.
The whole point of Beetle the Bard as a volume, though, seems to be to process those themes from the Harry Potter series through the lens of the fairy tale and through Dumbledore's commentary on it. And so the illustrations add to it as well. There's a piece in the new Ivory Tower volume by Chris Swank on the alchemical symbolism of the Fountain of Fair Fortune as well. And so that, you know, check out that chapter for what's going on there. I'll say too that there are also traces of letters in there that, to my knowledge, people have not deciphered. So, you know, I'll leave that as around the rims of the basins of the fountain. There seem to be traces of letters in there as well. They're really hard to distinguish from the picture of the falling water on it. So that makes it super difficult. I've got a couple guesses here about some of the words. I think it might say something like accept who you are, and then I can't make out a lot of the stuff in the middle, and then maybe it ends with and love yourself. But I've stared at that and bashed my head against my desk a lot on it. I'm really hoping that the community of Potter readers can find a solution and see if there's a hidden message in this one as well.
Yeah. Well, I wonder where the compassion is sort of the message of that story.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Right. I wonder where the original drawings are. Maybe it'd be easier to read
just
them.
To zoom in on them. I think they displayed maybe some of them at the British Museum exhibition a number of years ago on Harry Potter. So they may be floating around somewhere in an archive. That's a great question.
Need some high-res scans of those.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
You're leaving us with homework. Cool. Is what
yes.
Saying.
Sorry.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
It's awesome.
The so, professor can't stop professoring. Sorry.
Yeah, no, that's cool. You know, I was thinking, as we bring this around full circle to the idea of foundational texts, it's time flies, but love remains. But then we're also talking about these other ideas of what survives. And you had mentioned, for example, that we have the 9/11 memorial that has a Virgil quote on it. And you have a thought experiment in your chapter where you have people think about, like, you know, 2,000 years in the future, is there a memorial that has a Potter quote on it? And I'm really interested in this idea of what survives. Mm-hmm. And I'm interested to think, you know, do you think Harry Potter will survive, you know, and if it does, how is it going to survive? What do you think, Mitchell?
Oh, it's a great question. You know, I go back to the blurb on the back of the new Ivory Tower volume. Whited and her contributors consider the complicated legacy of Harry Potter and its author and explore how the series will evolve in the next 20 years. Indeed, I'm interested in maybe 100 times that. That particular cycle of 20 years. Let's try 2000 and see what this looks like. Of course, you know, not to get too bleak, who knows if there will be humans around in 2000 years, or, you know, things that can process written text, right? The classicist in
our
me
robot
is always,
overlords will right, be using it in all of their right, propaganda.
Yeah, the classicist in me is always worried about bottlenecks, right? Because we only have so much ancient literature, and the reason is that every time there was a change in technology, you lose stuff. So much like the process of converting from VHS to DVD, right? Not everything that was on VHS made it to DVD. Same deal throughout the centuries with book technology, and people are making choices constantly about what do we keep, what do we not keep. The stuff that's used in the classroom that enters the syllabus. It has a strong chance of staying around. So I feel like this is not a very carefully controlled experiment on my part for whether or not Harry Potter will survive, because I'm using it in the classroom. I'm kind of influencing that particular
not exactly
aspect
objective.
Of it.
Yeah.
Right. So, you know, again, it's impossible to accurately predict what people's reading trends and educational trends are going to be over the next few millennia. But at least as far as the kind of wide popular understanding of this text and interest in it, no better measure of that than the controversy over rolling taking public political stances, right? That people clearly have strong feelings about these novels and how they should be understood and how they should be used, that there's this massive community of readers out there. That's big. That's very big. And so I think that this is, at least in my own relatively short lifetime, without precedent, and has a chance to be something that sticks around. Of course, it becomes the question of, will we ever lose anything in the future, right? Do we have the ability to keep all texts in some server in the desert somewhere where they'll never be lost? At which point it becomes a matter of selecting what you do read from that big mass of things, which is a very different problem from those of from what we who study classical antiquity are faced with, the kind of diminishment over time of texts as opposed to a superabundance. But yeah, I would like to say that based on how people seem to be reacting to Harry Potter and how that reacts to and how that reflects how people reacted to a number of these foundational texts from thousands of years ago, quite possibly.
Chances are good.
Chances are good.
Mitchell, everything you do is just so exciting to me. I just all of your teaching and your, you know, your research. So what is listeners and us, what is next for you?
Well, that's super kind of you. I kind of had to gradually give myself permission to work on this for real, as I explained earlier. And it was really going to HPAC for the first time a year and a half ago that made me feel like I had that permission. I had given up on the idea of ever writing an academic book. You know, I kind of burned out on my dissertation and thought, okay, well, I've written a number of articles and things and kind of decided, okay, my institution doesn't require a book for tenure, so I'm not going to press myself on working on something that I've kind of lost the motivation for. But yeah, then a year and a half ago, I got back from HPAC and just wrote a chapter and a half of a book on the classics and Harry Potter and how Harry Potter positions itself as a kind of classic through this intertextual dialogue with works like Sophocles' Oedipus the King, Aeschylus' Oresteia, Virgil's Aeneid, all of these. So that's what I'm busily at work on whenever, of course, whenever teaching and parenting permit. So I hope that that I can wrap up that project at some point in the next few years.
I love it. That's great. And
that
so many people we've talked to on the show have a similar kind of trajectory, Mitchell. You know, that I was saying, like, that's what grad school does to you. But, you know, you do kind of you can kind of reach a limit on some of that. And then I find that the Harry Potter universe was refreshing, and I felt fertile after after I was engaging with this. It's a very nurturing community, the scholarly community too. And so I do think that's a great advantage of our scholarly field. Well, thank you so much, Mitchell Parks, for joining us on the show today, and I can't wait for your book about the classics to come out. That would be awesome. And we'll definitely have you on the show again.
Well, fingers crossed. And thank you so much. This has been a dream of mine. I would say that I wrote this chapter with the hopes of ending up chatting with you about it. I would not actually be lying that was a significant portion of the motivation in doing this, because I've loved this podcast so much for years.
Oh, that's so great.
So thank you so much.
Well, thanks, Mitchell. It's because of people like you that I think we are able to do what we do here. And so thank you so much for joining us today. So listeners, I hope you will indulge me for a rather longer closing quote than usual. It comes from the scene in which Rufus Scrimgeour presents each of the trio with gifts willed to them by Albus Dumbledore. And to Hermione, Dumbledore leaves his copy of The Tales of Beedle the Bard, quote, in the hope that she will find it entertaining and instructive. Scrimgeour now pulled out of the bag a small book that looked as ancient as the copy of Secrets of the Darkest Art upstairs. Its binding was stained and peeling in places. Hermione took it from Scrimgeour without a word. She held the book in her lap and gazed at it. Harry saw that the title was in runes. He had never learned to read them. As he looked, a tear splashed onto the embossed symbols. "Why do you think Dumbledore left you that book, Miss Granger?" asked Scrimgeour. He knew I liked books," said Hermione in a thick voice, mopping her eyes with her sleeve. "But why that particular book?" "I don't know. He must have thought I'd enjoy it." "Did you ever discuss codes or any means of passing secret messages with Dumbledore?" "No, I didn't," said Hermione, still wiping her eyes on her sleeve. "And if the Ministry hasn't found any hidden codes in this book in 31 days, I doubt that I will." She suppressed a sob. They were wedged together so tightly that Ron had difficulty extracting his arm to put it around Hermione's shoulders. Good luck, listeners, decoding all the ancient runes that you find in the Harry Potter series.
We hope you have enjoyed this episode of Potterversity. Send us your thoughts on the episode or propose ideas for future episodes by writing to potterversitypodcast@gmail.com. If you like the show, consider leaving a review on iTunes. And be sure to follow Potterversity on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Potterversity is brought to you by MuggleNet, the number one Wizarding World resource since 1999. Emma Nicholson is technical director, and the show is produced by Laurie Beckhoff. Our theme music is performed by The Town, featuring Sean Elsbernd, Scott Hacker, Travis Princey, Ashley Shepherd, and Emily Strand, and produced by Sean Elsbernd. I'm your announcer, Dr. Sarah Brown.
Until next time, class dismissed.